Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. One of my favorite resources to find out about the cutting edge of scientific research in my area of Northern California is the University of California at Davis. I subscribe to their science newsletter, edited by Kat Curlin, and I also follow her on Twitter. So when I found out she did a podcast with Amy Quinton, I started listening and loved it. It's called Unfold, and it was Quinton's idea to name it that, as you'll hear later on in our interview. Amy Quinton is a great example of how an excellent journalist can discover a love of science by covering it. Unfold is a wonderfully produced podcast that takes you into the field with UC Davis scientists in a series of programs revolving around a central theme like food insecurity, a natural fit for the college known around the world for its agricultural research. And currently, they're delving into the existential threat of climate change. Amy joins us from her home studio. Amy Quinton, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you, Dave.
First of all, I'd like you to tell our audience a little bit about the podcast. Just give us, your elevator speech. What's your podcast? What's it about? Where do you find it?
Well, it's called Unfold, and it's a production of UC Davis. And we call it Unfold because we take complicated problems and we break them down, we unfold them, and we look for solutions. In particular, this season, which I think is probably what you're asking more about, we are unfolding climate science. So we're looking at all different aspects of climate science.
Cool. Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, what does Unfold mean? Because it's almost like, as I was listening to some of your climate stories, I was thinking, yes, this is unfolding right before my eyes, this whole thing. So, and we'll take a deeper dive into your podcast in a bit. But it really is important for scientists to be able to do that, because when it comes down to it, if you're working at a university, and most scientists are at universities or they're working for NASA or NOAA or something like that, it's the public that's paying your salary. It's paying for the science. And it really is kind of your responsibility to be able to communicate what you're doing to them.
Right, exactly. And in a way that they can understand it, right? Because if all you do is communicate in a way that's way above them, then what research has found is that they start to not trust you. You're talking with all these big words. I'm not understanding you. I don't trust you. And that's not what you want, right?
Yeah. And well, when you look at the titles of, if you look at academic papers, and I read them all the time when I'm going to have a guest on, I will read their paper because I'm, am conversant in their language. But when you look at the, some of the titles of the academic papers, dynamic dispersion of brown dwarfs around, binary systems or something like that, you just
exactly.
Go, yeah, okay, well, that's something not many people are going to want to talk about. But then when you break it down to, the basics of it, it's a lot of fun. Let's talk about you a bit. How did you get into this? Your background is in journalism, right?
Correct.
So when did you get into radio? When was your first exposure to that?
Well, actually, I started out in journalism. I started out in television news, and I did that for about 4 years. And hated it. I think I just was shy of in terms of going in front of the camera. Mm-hmm. But I always loved public radio. I always listened to public radio. And I fell in love with sound. And so that's sort of how I got into public radio anyway. And then I was a general assignment reporter. And I literally fell into the environmental science beat. My editor one day said, "We need an environmental science reporter. Can you do it, Amy?" And I'm like, "Sure. Why not? Sounds good." I'd done a couple of environment stories, but didn't have any sort of real, specialization in it by any stretch of the imagination. And when I started covering it and when I started talking to scientists, I literally fell in love with it. Hmm. And I ended up being an environment reporter for 20 years thereabouts before I started working here at UC Davis.
And with all your tremendous background of all you've done over the years of environmental science reporting, if you could go back and talk to your younger self and tell her some advice, what would you tell her?
I'd say be a marine biologist.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of joking. I just really love the ocean. Mm-hmm. And now that I've talked to scientists all the time, I'm really enamored by it, I think is the word. I just, I find scientists to be wonderful. They're passionate about their work, and it's infectious. And I think that's sort of why I fell in love with environmental science, because you get to go outside, right? And I love the outdoors. So I'm sort of joking when I say, like, I'd be a marine biologist, because I was never very good at math. I don't know if you're the same way, but, like, I can't do math at all. And you really need a math background. You need a really sort of analytical background to really do science well. And I'm not, you know, they spend hours and hours and hours doing such meticulous work in labs that I don't think I have the patience for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why some people who have science backgrounds go into, you know, SciComm, science communication, is that they find that I don't want to just spend my whole time dealing with one thing. I want to know about all kinds of things, and it gives you an avenue to do that. And that's what the beauty of what we do is, you get to talk to so many different scientists about so many different topics, even if it's just, you know, on a theme of climate change. You get to talk to so many people about so many different things that it's always so interesting.
It is. And it doesn't matter what story I'm doing, because I'm always constantly learning. And I think that's really, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. And even working at a university is the best, right? Because you're constantly in a classroom. But even having covered the environment for 20 years, I'm doing this season now on climate change, and I'm constantly learning more. You know, this season we did a episode on oceans, and I thought I knew everything about the ocean. And turns out I didn't know a lot about the ocean. Just really interesting stuff about ocean acidification and how it's affecting organisms. I learned a lot about transportation that I didn't know before. And so I just think it's great. I think it's great. I have a great job.
Yeah. And you get to learn and then share that knowledge with your audience. And it's just, it's such a win-win. It's a wonderful thing. I love what I do. And I know you do too.
So you're a science teacher too?
Yeah, I have been. I'm, you know, on the cusp of retirement. And I'll continue doing this. I kind of fell into this about 15 years ago. But I had, you know, I really have had a long background doing radio, and I would be the guy that the local TV station would contact, you know, hey, there's a meteor shower. Can you come on the air and, you know, or an eclipse? Can you come on the air and we'll come out to your school and can you explain to us and, you know, we'll get some shots of you and kids with a telescope or whatever. Or I'd go into the studio and make a comet for them when, you know, Comet Hyakutake or Hale-Bopp were coming through in the 90s. So I had a background of doing that kind of thing. Or a local radio show would say, you know, we've got astronaut Alan Shepard coming to our station, and we don't really know anything about that. Would you be interested in coming and helping us interview him? And I was like, yeah. Yeah, the first American in space and one of my greatest heroes, you bet. So I've had a long background of that science communication through the media. And then when this happened, it was great. But as far as the science teaching goes, that's kind of a different gig. You're dealing with a very different audience of teenagers, and you're just trying to motivate them to, you know, get things done and get the best grades they can and teach them how to learn. And by the way, you know, science isn't as horrible as you think it is. So you're dealing with that all the time. So I enjoy this because I get to talk to, you know, really smart people, the smartest people on the planet, literally, like you do, you know, all the time, every week. And it's kind of a wonderful way to segue from 14 to 16 year old minds,
right,
to these fully developed, fully functional people. And one thing I always try to get across to my students is, and I'd like you to maybe address this, is there's such a stereotype that people have, you know, of all ages about what scientists are like. And when you get to be around them and talk to them all the time, what would you like to say to to counter those stereotypes? What are scientists really like based on your experience?
I think they're like all of us. You know, I don't think that they're any different than anyone else, and they're all different. I think there is this stereotype of like this geeky person who doesn't know how to communicate with anyone in a lab. And that's just not the case. I find that they're very passionate about their work. And, you know, they should be, because they're saving the world. Mm-hmm. And especially you look at what's going on now in the world with this pandemic. I mean, how important are they? So we should actually idolize scientists.
Oh, yeah. And not just idolize them, but also just admire the fact that, you know, they get to go to work every day, literally, you know, trying to do something really important for all of us and for the planet. And, you know, what they have such meaningful jobs to go to.
Right. And sometimes it's hard to see that when you ask, like we have scientists at UC Davis, they're very, very specialized, right? Mm-hmm. I talked to a woman who, she studies the way genes are regulated in the potato and the tomato. And you sort of go, so what? Like, why are you doing this, right? But then you realize what she's really trying to do is stop food waste. Because when you have a tomato, the best way to preserve a tomato is to put it in the refrigerator. But what happens when you put it in the refrigerator is it gets injured, right? If you take it out and you taste it, it doesn't taste good anymore. And it kind of gets all sort of grainy. You've done this before, right?
Yeah, because we have a garden and I have fresh tomatoes. And I don't eat them when they've been in the refrigerator.
Right, right. So it's called post-harvest chilling injury. And it happens to like 60% of the produce that we eat. And so what we end up doing is throwing it away, right, and wasting food, which is terrible when we have all this population and so many people that can't feed themselves. So she looks at ways to manipulate the genes inside the tomato to maybe prevent that from happening so that we can store our produce longer and feed more people. So, wow. Right, so something very specific, but has such an amazing, like, end result, right, if she can get us there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Quinton. She co-hosts the Unfold Science podcast from the University of California, Davis, along with her co-host, Kat Curlin. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with Amy Quinton. Along with Kat Curlin, she's the co-host of Unfold, a science podcast from UC Davis. I want to know about your partner, because you have such a wonderful back-and-forth relationship. Tell me about Kat Curlin.
Kat Curlin is amazing. She is another science communicator in the news and media relations department with me. She has been also covering climate science, I think, for over a decade. And she does wonderful work. And she has a website where most of the research that she writes about is on. It's the Climate and Science website, climatechange.ucdavis.edu. So there's her plug. But it's all it's a great website, multimedia, about all of UC Davis's research and climate science. And we really just started working this season together because the pandemic happened sort of right in the middle of us trying to figure out how we were going to do this season. My former co-host took another job. And so all of this just sort of sent our podcast and to this uncertainty. But Kat and I started talking, and it's her beat. And so it just seems like a really natural fit. And she's got a great voice. So I'm very happy with it. And I'm happy with her. And she's really easy to listen to.
Yeah, and you two just have such a nice back and forth that when you're having your banter together, it's just, you're fun to listen to,
the two
of you together. Yeah, I enjoyed that. And then what was the genesis of the whole project? You kind of mentioned that, but how did you come up with the idea for let's do this podcast called Unfold?
Well, it kind of started a little different than that. It was more like, let's do a podcast. How do we do it? And it was, we wanted to showcase our scientists at UC Davis, not just scientists, but all of our expertise. So social science, healthcare, all of it. And how do we do that? What are we doing at UC Davis that sets ourselves apart? And so we have what we call communications pillars, right? And so one of them is climate science or science and climate. Another one is agriculture, how we're going to feed a growing population, how we're going to advance healthcare worldwide. And then just all the other research we have that sort of, you know, we kind of call it curiosity, the stuff that makes you go, wow, you know, all the science that we have, it's like, wow, I didn't know that. Or social sciences, economics. So we have this like huge umbrella of all this expertise, and we want to do a podcast in it with it. And so we decided to basically break it up into these little umbrellas of seasons. It's the best way to do it. Last season, we did how we're going to feed a growing population. This season, we're doing climate science. We don't know what we're doing next season yet. Hopefully we will soon, though. So we all got together in a room and decided we're going to do a podcast on our expertise. How are we going to explain all these complex problems that the world has in an easy way, right? And I came up with the name of Unfold. It just came up and it worked. And amazingly, nobody had that as a name. So we got it.
Yeah, that's the hard part nowadays.
I know.
And maybe a suggestion is UC Davis has such an incredible medical center and the UC Davis Health, the umbrella of expertise there.
Yes.
Maybe something in the medical fields you might investigate.
Yes.
You know, that is
That is coming, definitely. Yeah.
Any University of California is a pretty amazing place, but Davis is very special. What would be something you could say about Davis that really, you know, makes it unique, sets it apart from the other UC campuses?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot.
I am. You know, I feel like the chancellor. Come on now and sell us.
I think what makes UC Davis special is that they really have a collaborative approach with solving problems. They really like to work in teams and have everyone work together as a team on a problem, and they call it cross-discipline, right? I'm in the English department, but I'm really good at this, and I'm going to work with you on that, you know. And So you learn about each other's backgrounds, different backgrounds, on solving a problem. And, I mean, that's what it's going to take to solve some of these really complex problems that the world is facing. And I think that is what sets UC Davis apart, is that they have this collaborative approach of problem solving.
Yeah, well, and it reminds me, we were talking about Carl Sagan earlier, and early in his career, when he was starting out, science was all completely specialized. And, you know, if you were, say, an astrophysicist studying galaxies, you know, nobody ever talked to anybody that was interested in the solar system or the planets. And let alone somebody who was studying that, talking to a geologist about, you know, rocks and things like that, or a biologist. And now, if you look at the sciences, they are so, science is so integrated. You know, when you're a planetary scientist, you have to understand, you know, the geology, and you might be interested in astrobiology and how does that interact with, you know, the possibility of life. Science is so much more integrated now. And that's how I think it should be taught. And kind of what you're talking about there is how, you know, you're using all the disciplines to, conquer problems.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting you said that because one of the reasons I started working at UC Davis, well, it's not the reason I started working at UC Davis, but how I got interested in UC Davis was I had the opportunity as an environment reporter to go rafting down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon with a class of UC Davis students. And it was an eco-geomorphology class. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was,
I'm jealous.
Yeah. No, it was great. It was ecologists and geologists, and there was even an entomologist, and there were wildlife biologists, and they, you know, put them all on one raft and see what you learn going through the Grand Canyon. And it was just an amazing experience because you'd walk 2 feet and learn something. Oh, here's this bug. Here's what it does. Oh, here's what happened, you know, 7 billion years ago or whatever. You know, it was great. And so I really got to know a lot of the folks at UC Davis. So when this job presented itself, I couldn't pass it up.
Yeah. And when you go to someplace like the Grand Canyon or any national park like Yosemite or Lassen Volcanic National Park, which is now part of the UC Natural Reserve System, we're now one of your newest parcels or whatever you want to units. You get a much greater, deeper appreciation of a place when you understand as much as possible about it. You know, the history of the indigenous peoples that live there and how they utilize the resources, the geology and the story through the depths of time of how it became that way. And all the various kinds of trees. Like when I go up to Lassen Park, I love the mountain hemlocks up there. They're one of my favorite trees. And they look like they look like Dr. Seuss characters to me when I see them.
Yes.
And then I was reading one day John Muir, you know, writing that his favorite tree was the mountain hemlock. And he said, and there's a particularly fine stand there at the slopes of Mount Lassen, you know, and I saw that and went, wow, that's so cool.
Yes. Yeah.
So you've done a season on food scarcity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're well into this climate change. And I've listened to a few of the episodes. They're really interesting. Can you give us an example of, you know, you're interviewing these wonderful scientists with this incredible expertise. Can you give us an example of, you know, how somebody communicated something in a unique way that you really found, oh, this is great to share on your podcast?
Sure. We did an episode on how climate change is affecting the ocean. And well, we all know the ocean is warming, and most of us have heard about ocean acidification, but we wanted to unfold that a bit more. So I talked to Tessa Hill, and she's one of our oceanographers, and she's a chemist as well, and with our Coastal and Marine Sciences Institute, to sort of just explain to me, like, what is ocean acidification? Because I think a lot of us have heard it, but we're not really sure what that really means or how it affects things. So I'm just going to play a little bit here.
And the ocean is a tremendous sponge for that carbon dioxide. So it actually soaks up about 30% of what we put in the atmosphere goes straight into the ocean. And so we used to think about this as, wow, the ocean is doing such a great favor for us, right? Like it seems like it's taking carbon out of the atmosphere that would have produced even more climate change, and it's being stored in the ocean instead. And then over time, we realized that adding all of that carbon dioxide to the ocean fundamentally changes the chemistry of the ocean. It makes it very slightly, but measurably, more acidic.
So the reason I like that is it just is so simple, right? Mm-hmm. It's a simple explanation of something. And that's something that we try to get scientists to do all the time. A lot of scientists fear sort of talking to the press in particular that they're going to have to dumb something down, right? We hear this all the time. Oh, I don't want to talk to them. I'm going to have to dumb it down. But it's not about dumbing it down. It's about speaking in very simple phrases because everyone is capable of understanding something complex. You just have to say it simply. And I love the way that she uses a metaphor and talks about the ocean doing us a favor and how it's a tremendous sponge. And I also, if I could, play one more.
Sure.
I asked her to explain, like, why making the ocean more acidic, how it's affecting shelled organisms, which I had heard about but didn't really understand how that happened.
Ooh, yeah.
So anything that makes a hard part, like a coral reef or an oyster or a mussel, it's basically pulling the components of that shell out of seawater. And so it's making that shell from building blocks in the seawater. And it turns out that how abundant those building blocks are is dependent upon the pH of the ocean.
So, I mean, she could have used terms like that I've heard scientists use before, like carbonate ion concentration and calcium carbonate minerals. And like really, because she's a chemist, right? I sort of actually kind of expected to hear this when I was asking her about ocean acidification, but I didn't. She said something that was really easy to understand. Building blocks, like we can all grasp that. We don't have to know sort of all the minutiae to understand that like an oyster can't produce a shell because, you know, the ocean has changed and it can't grab those building blocks from the seawater. I don't think that's dumbing it down. I think it's making it a really interesting.
Making it accessible.
Making it accessible, right, to anyone.
And, you know, when I heard that, I started thinking of all those times, like in a geology lab, when we were trying to identify limestone that was like fossiliferous limestone formed from, you know, ancient seashells, little tiny, you know, seashells. And what you do is take hydrochloric acid and drip it on it and it would fizz. And, you know, it's like that made me think of that. Well, that's what's happening. That fizzing is it's breaking down. Those little shells, the building blocks of those shells, and that's how you know that that's what's there is that those building blocks, that calcium carbonate that shells are made of, the acid is, you know, basically dissolving it.
Correct. And yeah, as part of that episode, I also interviewed a graduate student who's working on basically looking at the way the warming ocean temperatures are affecting oysters. Here on the San Francisco in the Bay Area, Tamales Bay. I joined her there. And one of the things we do on the Unfold is we take people places, or we try to. It's kind of got hard during the pandemic to do this, but we were able to socially distance some interviews. And Priya Shukla is a graduate student. She's hoping to maybe understand how to create an oyster that can tolerate warming ocean temperatures, because what's happening now is they often are very susceptible to a particularly bad kind of virus. So she's looking at that, and she was just wonderful. And one of the things that I will say about science communication is that if they are passionate about that work, you can hear it in a podcast. And she was great at that.
Yeah. Do you have a clip of her?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. That's okay.
Sorry.
You got me so excited. I was ready to, but that leads me to my next question, is one of the things I love about your podcast and what sets it apart, you know, is mine is pretty simple. It's kind of like fresh air for science. It's just me playing, you know, Terry Gross Jr., talking to, you know, scientists and people, and not just scientists. I talk to all kinds of people, artists, musicians, you name it.
But yeah, why are you
usually
talking to
with
me?
usually some kind of science bent, but because you're a world-class journalist, that's why, Amy. You are. One of the things that sets your podcast apart is you have this ability to do all these soundscapes where you're taking us out in the field. Like one of my favorite segments was it was about rock dust, I think it was, and how it might be something you could use to fight climate change. And Kat had a recording that she played for you, and it was just this noisy machine sound. And you're like, I don't know, what is that noisy machine sound? And it was like rock crushing going on.
Yeah, it was a giant mine.
Yeah, I could instantly picture this rock getting crushed, and you know that I was there, and then all this, you know, rock dust was going in the air, and then you guys explained how that works. So I love the way that you can take us out in the field and you get to hear, you know, what these sounds are like. So could you talk about like some of the challenges of doing that?
Well, actually it's interesting because that story in particular, we followed our researcher around for a year. I mean, the very first interview I did with Ben Holton was at the mine when they're looking for dust because your listeners won't know. They're looking at adding pulverized volcanic rock to croplands as a way to sequester carbon. And they get this pulverized rock from mines up here in the foothills in California. And so I went with him, I followed him, and this was a year ago, to get a tour of the mine and to understand, you know, what this rock dust looks like. And it had a lot of great sound opportunities. And then I went with him to the farm when they were actually doing the experiment and applying the rock dust to the soil. So that was before the pandemic. And so now we sort of then went on, like, probably you did too. Okay, there's a pandemic. I don't have a studio. How do I do this podcast? And it took some trial and error. And then eventually, you know, when it became sort of okay to see somebody from a distance, I'm like, well, maybe we can still go out and do something. And we were able to, especially with the ocean episode, I was able to go out in the open. I have a boom pole, so I'm able to stay, you know, more than 6 feet away. And I agree. It's my favorite part. I mean, it's why I was a reporter. I get to go outside. Don't put me in a newsroom. As long as I'm outside, I'm happier. Yeah. And so that's one of the, you know, I've always loved climate science for that reason, and environmental reporting for that reason, is you get to go out. You get to go outside. So, but or, it,
and go ahead.
No, I just think it's important when you're doing audio to try to take the listener somewhere.
Yeah. You do that really well. And that's one of the things I love about your podcast is, you know, it's got this whole wonderful package to it where the two of you and Kat are having these discussions and kind of setting us up for the story. And then you bring in these wonderful scientists and them telling us about their work and how it relates to what you're doing. And then we get to go out in the field and hear what it sounds like. And it feels like you're there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I love about it.
It's cool.
It takes a while to produce it that way. So you have to be really patient.
How long does it take to make like an episode like that?
Well, so it depends. It depends on how well the person I've interviewed can sum up their research. I'll tell you the longest episode and how long it took. The longest episode, I went to Kenya in January to follow some of the research that we're doing here at UC Davis, helping basically pastoral farmers in Africa when drought hits and their animals have nothing left to eat. They starve. They're trying to prevent them from falling so deep into poverty that they starve. And it's a terribly depressing story. I hate to like even bring it up, but it is what it is. So I went there in January, and it involved translators. It involved, it was just so involved. I must have interviewed 15 people, maybe more. And it took me 2 months to write it. It was well over 4,500 words. And it took me, it took me a week or so to produce it, if not longer. So it can take quite some time, I'm sure your producer knows.
Well, no, we don't. Yeah, because he did the California Burning series. And yes, that took a long time. And one of the episodes that we kind of have an overlap with is you just did the story about the California wildfires and the science of what's going on there. And I was so struck by, you know, all that I've learned in the last, you know, few years about our forests and how, because of these fires, you know, everybody gets the idea that, well, it's too bad and everything, but the trees will come back and the forest will come back. And what we're observing based on talking to the scientists that you talk to is that in a lot of these places, the forests are not coming back.
Right, right. And so I talked with Andrew Latimer. He's one of our forest ecologists at UC Davis and was able to go out into the woods again before the pandemic. And he sort of showed me these sites that where there's been previous fires and what's happened to them. And I think it was the American River Fire or American Fire. It happened in 2008. And it was a large conifer forest. And it's come back. They're replanting in some areas. It's come back. Most of it is shrub. Not that there's something bad about shrub. It's just a different landscape. And we're seeing that happen more and more. And actually, I can play something from him.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So what scientists call this is they're called habitat shifts, right? Where you're seeing conifer forests change to like a shrubland or a grassland. And here's what Andrew Latimer said about that.
That's a really hard thing. I mean, it's especially hard if it's your own backyard and you fear or you realize that maybe this is never going to be the way it was again. And I think a lot of people are starting to face that in some areas, especially areas that are kind of like at a transition zone at the edge of the forest. And that's something that, you know, we're wrestling with as scientists and land managers are wrestling with as well, because it's really hard to give up on a site that you've thought should be forest, even if the projections for climate change suggest you shouldn't have trees. You know, it really won't support trees there anymore.
Yeah, I just that struck me as, if nothing else, this last year with everything that's gone on with the pandemic and the terrible fires, you know, I've been trapped inside my home and my studio here, you know, for weeks on end, just with air purifiers running because the smoke was so horrible here, as it was for many people throughout the West, and being in constant fear, as I am now, because we have a red flag warning and a big one coming for Sunday night and Monday, which will be in the past for when this airs. But I'm frightened. You know, I have to have my go bag ready, my animal supplies, my generator ready in case the power goes out. It's been a frightening summer. And if nothing else, this whole thing, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, is you've been covering climate change and environmental science for decades. And it really seems like now it's like it's just hitting us in the face.
It's definitely hitting us in the face. I mean, I thought it couldn't get worse than what happened with the campfire. I mean, we had some of my husband's family lost their home, so it did hit home. And we're just seeing these fires just change so much of the landscape. Not all fire is bad. I'm sure you've talked about this in your podcast. And every time I say, you know, they're getting larger and they're getting more severe, I feel like I'm also, I don't want to do a disservice to the good that some fires do. But that's not what we're seeing now, right?
We're seeing these mega fires.
Right, these mega giga fires is a new term I heard.
Oh, goodness. Now we're to billions. Now we're to the 10 to the 9th fires. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it seems like, and it's not just the fires, you know, it's the weather pattern change that I'm observing, that, you know, it's just dry and hot and windy, and it feels like literally this is turning into Arizona instead of Northern California.
Right.
And I know you did a show about that.
Right. Well, we called the episode on wildfires that we did hotter, drier, windier, because that's exactly what's happening. Is we've always had wind, but it's always hit. We're having this like emerging sort of, we're having all of it hit at once, right? We have an arid landscape, then it's getting warmer, and then the winds are blowing and there's dry conditions on the ground. So it just sort of like culminates in this sort of inferno. It's terrible. So we call that hotter, drier, windier for that very fact. But yes, becoming Arizona came directly from the California Fourth Climate Change Assessment that some of our researchers at UC Davis worked on, that showed basically, you know, by 2100, Sacramento is going to feel more like Phoenix, where you have, I think, I probably have the exact numbers wrong, but we're going to have several more days over 100 than we do now, so that we will feel more like Phoenix or Arizona. And so the podcast was on that fact, like, what is that going to mean? How can cities adapt to heat? And some of what Kat did in this series, she did a whole series on this and looked at different aspects of heat, from heat islands to the people that it affects the most. Heat as a disaster is actually the worst disaster. There's more people that die from heat-related illness than hurricanes and flooding combined. You know, from all the disasters you hear about from climate change, heat illness is much worse. And so we looked at that in that podcast episode.
Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll continue my interview with Amy Quinton, co-host of Unfold, a science podcast unraveling themes like food insecurity and climate change, featuring UC Davis researchers. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. Let's return to our conversation with science journalist Amy Quinton from the University of California, Davis. I still am around a lot of people that don't accept that climate change is real, or that it's caused by people, or even if they kind of do, they just like, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about it, so, you know, don't worry about it.
Yeah, how do you get past that? I think it's something that we as a nation we're struggling with right now, right?
Yeah, it's I'm going to editorialize here. I find it deeply unfortunate and troubling that one of the major political parties glommed onto this issue as being something they wanted to go against a long time ago and have become entrenched in climate change denial. And that's the Republican Party. You know, it's like not all Republicans are that way, but the vast majority are, or at least that's the policies that they promote. And it's unfortunate. It shouldn't be a political issue. It's just, it's a fact of nature. It's what's happening. It's simple physics. You put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and it gets warmer.
Well, you know, the first episode that we did this season was on climate change and the coronavirus and any sort of lessons that can be learned from how we're handling both crises. And one of the things that one of our climate scientists, Ben Holton, talked about is sort of that very thing, the politicizing of science, right? We're seeing it in the pandemic, the whole like mask wearing. And he said something, he's like, the politicizing of it is just doesn't surprise him at all. Like, not at all, because we've been doing that for so long with the climate change debate. And he said, you can take somebody that doesn't believe in climate science and show them as much data as you possibly can showing that, yes, in fact, climate change is real. And they won't believe it because it affects the economy to fix it. But, you know, I don't think that's necessarily the case, because as we hear, you can create many, many jobs from fighting climate change. I mean, just look at our energy sector and renewables. But, you know, Ben Holton was talking about that very thing, this whole politicization of the science.
Yeah, and I would counter with this when somebody, and I do, and that's why people don't like to argue with me, because they just like, well, let's talk about something else. What economy are you saving? Because, you know, if you look down the road to 2050, our economy is going to be in tatters and shreds if we don't do anything about this, because we can't have an economy in a world that warms to that level.
Trillions of dollars of economic damage is what scientists say will happen.
And, you know, the big insurance companies and the U.S. military and you know, people in the know, they know this. They know that it's true. So it's just, it's unfortunate that it's not getting through to, you know, the majority of people so that we could all kind of pull our oars in one direction and start. Because we, you know, we were an ingenious enough species to develop the internal combustion engine, which basically, and the Industrial Revolution, which gave us this, you know, wonderful, comfortable lifestyle. We're smart enough to do that. We're smart enough to figure out another way to keep, still have a wonderful lifestyle without burning fossil fuels.
Right, right.
We're smart enough to do that. People at UC Davis are certainly smart enough. So before I let you go, So looking into the future here with your next sets of podcasts, you know, what are like some of the things that you have in the back of your mind that you really would like to explore that you've never gotten to do before?
Oh, wow. I have such a choice, right? Yeah. I mean, I think for next season, we're probably going to end up focusing on the sort of what we like to call curiosity, the things that, like I said, make you go, huh, that's interesting. And so, and I think it's because people need a break.
Yeah.
People yes. don't really probably want to hear about like climate change right now and or healthcare, which we were going to talk about healthcare. And I just, you know, yeah. I think people are just burnt
fatigued.
Out.
Fatigued.
Yes.
Yes, I've kind of, you know, I've shied away from pandemic issues on my show and tried to do things that are, you know, something else to give people a mental break away from it. And, you know, climate change, I feel a responsibility to at least, you know, once every 5 or 6 shows, I got to come back to that because it's the most important scientific issue of our time. So I won't leave that alone.
Right.
But I do think they need a break. They need some fun adventure. You know, let's talk to the guitar player for Blue Oyster Cult to explain to us, like, what's all the technology that allows you to make all these incredible sounds now that they didn't have back when Blue Oyster Cult started in 1970s and you were hitting the cowbell to make
cowbell.
Don't Fear the Reaper. Yeah.
The infamous cowbell.
Yes.
Right. Or like, you know, I've always wanted to go out and do something. We have a bug museum, right? We have this huge, like, drawers and drawers and drawers of this major collection of all these bugs from all over the place. And it would just be great to, like, just walk around with our expert talking about all these strange bugs. We have a sample of one of the newest, I think it's a mosquito, that was named after Donald Trump because apparently,
so many jokes are coming to mind. I'm not going to go there, but yeah. Okay.
Apparently he has a big orange sort of thing on his head that makes it look like Donald Trump hair. But I also hear there's another reason he's called that. And I don't know if you're going to want this on your show, but apparently
I can imagine. Go ahead.
Apparently, it has very, very tiny genitalia.
Oh, well, okay. I wouldn't know, and I'm glad that I don't know about that. I don't want to know about that. I don't mind knowing about the mosquito, though. That's interesting.
But it's really interesting. Either way, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, aside from fascinatingly named mosquitoes, and I imagine there's just some, you know, insects are just so amazing. And that brings me to mind. I'm fascinated by bees. And I was really interested, and we were speaking the other day on the phone, that you had a real fear of bees, don't you?
Oh, it's really bad.
But you are a trooper. Are you suited up? And did you go out and amongst the bees?
I did. I suited up in a bee suit. And I was recording everything for a story I was doing for Capital Public Radio, and they zipped me up, and I got the sounds of them zipping me up. But what happened was, so bees like black things. They like black clothing. That's why the bee suit is white. Mm. And the beekeeper that I was with did not inform me of this. And so I have my microphone out.
Oh, and it's black.
And it's black, right? Ooh. And so all of these bees just like swarm the microphone. And I have the headphones on and it's really loud. It likes the microphone.
It's the color. They don't like dark,
dark colors.
Yeah, you're reaching your hand on the bee.
Yeah.
He doesn't wear gloves.
I know, crazy.
You've even got one on. You like that? Look at that.
Oh, no, I don't like it.
Okay.
And so I think they're attacking me. I mean, it was just frightening.
Oh, gosh, I guess. You don't see too many white microphones out there.
Right. But I got great sound, so.
Oh, cool. You took one for the team.
I did.
I've got to listen to that sometime because I'm wondering about, you know, can I hear the terror in your voice?
Probably.
When, you know, I have bees in my backyard and I have no fear of them, but they're not around their hive. There's nothing that they're protecting. But I did learn something interesting from one of your scientists that I didn't know, is because I've always been fascinated by bees' ability to find water. And he told me, he said, well, that's because they have polarized vision. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, think about all of us that like to go fishing and we wear polarized glasses so that we can, you know, see through the water and, you know, tilt our head and see the different ways the water reflects or doesn't reflect. And I said, that is so cool. That's why the bees like me, because I wear my Ray-Bans, my Wayfarers that are polarized. They must know I'm one of them.
Isn't science fascinating?
It is. Just to, you know, it's like I would have never known that bees have polarized vision. It's like, how cool is that? Well, it's been so fun to talk to you, and good luck with the podcast. Now, how, for our listeners that are, you know, looking for more cool science content, you know, you listen to Blue Dot Number One, but, you know, Unfold is definitely, definitely worth your time. How can they go about finding you and subscribing?
Well, they can find us on any of the podcast platforms, Apple, Google, Spotify. We should be on all of them, but we also have a website at ucdavis.edu/unfold.
Yeah, wherever you get your podcast.
And wherever you get your podcast.
Yeah. So, hey, thanks so much, Amy. I enjoyed talking to you, and it's fun to talk to somebody that does what I do, but you get to go out in the field. I go out in the field, but I don't take a microphone. I just go out and explore and get inspiration because I love to be in national parks. Do you have a favorite national park?
Oh, there's so many. I think Zion is my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I love rocks.
I was there once, yeah. And it was even better than 4K.
Well, thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks again to our guest, Amy Quinton. I really enjoy her work on Unfold and think you will too. You can check out the podcast she co-hosts with Kat Curlin on UC Davis's website, ucdavis.edu/unfold. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX, and if you missed an episode or want to share one, check out our archives at mynspr.org. Subscribe to our podcast via the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.